Okay, for those of us upstairs, we're in Colossians, and we're in the third chapter. We're going to make a few comments on the closing verses of the third chapter, and then there's a couple of key elements of the fourth chapter that I'd like to at least touch on. Obviously, we don't have time to do a verse-by-verse thoroughness, but I think there are some good things for us to extract. And we got down through the 16th verse of chapter 3 of Colossians last night. I started in on the family section, which begins with verse 18, but I'd like to go back and just make a comment or two on verse 17, which is such an excellent verse. And whatsoever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God and the Father by Him. This is a verse that gives us an indication that we are to respect the authority of Christ. It's probably maybe an apex of the dedication of Christ, to Christ, our willingness to do that. And the name of Christ, as I probably have mentioned, stands for more than an identification tag. It has to do with His authority, His love, His deity, His grace, etc. Do everything through the authority, acknowledging the power of Christ. Albert Barnes, in his commentary, wrote, "Do all because He requires and commands it with a desire to honor Him. His authority should be the warrant, His glory the aim of all of our actions and words." And one of the best tests of any action is, can we do it honoring Christ? You know, we've seen the bracelets, "What Would Jesus Do?" But I think it's as good, if not a little better, to think, can I do this when we're trying to make a decision? Can I do this, and will it honor Christ if I do do it? And can we ask for God's help as we do do it? Now we're going to move to the family. And I didn't really start it last night. I just gave you a slide that says we're going there. But we're now in verses 18 and 19 and 20. Well, 21. But let me just do 18 and 19 to start with. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as is fit in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and be not bitter against them. And these sentiments are not included simply here in this passage. In a more expansive way, Paul in Ephesians chapter 5, beginning with about verse 21 to the end of that chapter, there's about 11 or 12 verses in which he gives his most probably articulate comment on the husband-wife marriage relationship. And it's interesting in Ephesians, when he does that, he spends a lot of time on the husband and wife before he ever talks about the children. And I've kind of thought that that was because Paul understood, the Holy Spirit understood, that a marriage and a family is built around the marriage, not around the children. Children are an important part of a family if you or I choose to have them. But if we build our family simply around our children, when our children grow and leave, then maybe husband and wife don't have that much in common, and we see people having struggles in their marriages because they were held together by their children rather than held together by their love one for another. I've always liked Proverbs chapter 24, verses 3 and 4, which I have put up here. Through wisdom a house is built, and by understanding it is established. By knowledge the rooms are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. And obviously there's the issue of wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, which leads to it being properly built, established, and filled. Now, earlier we talked a little bit about wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, but in general I think these articulations of these words are the ability to discern beyond the surface. And by that I mean in the home we ought to be able to know one another well enough that despite what we might say, we can see beyond that or beneath it. A teenager comes in or a child comes in from school and you say, "How was your day?" And they say, "Fine." Well, how they say fine is going to tell you a lot, isn't it? Because sometimes fine means fine, and sometimes fine in a different tone means don't ask me. I just leave me alone. I tend to, when I'm on the road, and I probably share this with you, call Donna at least once a day, and I ask her, how is she doing? But she almost doesn't have to tell me because the tone of her voice tells me how she's doing. And she's usually doing pretty good. But it's that ability to look below the surface. In a marriage, husbands, we need to learn that men are fixers. Let me put it that way. And sometimes women don't necessarily want you to fix their problem. They want you to listen to their problem, and they'll figure out how to fix it as they're talking. And it sometimes takes us a long time to figure that out, and we don't get it. And it's so simple, because we got this left brain, right brain thing going. And so, well, this is obvious, just do this. Well, that's not necessarily the way your wife's thinking. And ladies, you need to be patient with us, because we just want to get it done. And that's what makes us good, and the other's what makes you good. And that's why the fitly joining together. Here he talks about wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. In 1 Peter chapter 3, the admonition to the men is to dwell with your wives according to knowledge. That means get to know them. Well, obviously, I think it would be a pretty good idea to get to know them before you marry them. And that goes the other side of that coin, too. But if you don't know somebody, it really does make your relationship much more difficult. And that's true of our children also. Well, no wonder that's not working. I didn't put that little gizmo in. I did that once before. Okay, we'll proceed with the gizmo. So in these verses, wives, submit to your own husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be bitter toward them. And I think I mentioned this phrase last night, but I want to reemphasize this. This is the principle of reciprocal obligation. Wives, you've got an obligation to your husbands. Husbands, you've got an obligation to your wives. And if both the husband and the wife lives up to their obligations or duties, whatever you want to call them, it is amazing how wonderful a marriage can be. I understand it takes two to make a good marriage. But I have never seen a marriage fall apart if both parties were doing what the apostle here exhorts us to do. I've never seen a congregation split if all of the people were putting other people first. So I think that's a very important thing for us to keep in mind. In Luke chapter 14, verses 28 through 32, that's the passage that says, if you intend to build a tower, count first the cost. Or if you intend to go to war, count the cost. It is absolutely amazing to me, and probably to you, how many people enter into families, enter into marriages, and don't really count the cost. And then they don't understand why the home they have built, not the house they have built, the home they have built, doesn't fit. Well, you get two people from two different sides with different images of what a home should be. Well, it's not going to necessarily match. And most of us get an idea of what a marriage ought to be, but from our parents, good or bad. I know people say, this is what a marriage ought to be because this is what I saw growing up. And then others will say, this is what a marriage shouldn't be because that's what I saw when I'm growing up. But we get that image, we get that understanding. And when you first get married, those of you that are married and have been married for a while, it takes a little while to blend that all together. But with love for each other, it can happen. Oftentimes in a marriage, you get a spender and a saver. And I'm not sure that's bad, because you don't want two savers, because they never do anything. You don't want two spenders, but it takes a while to figure that all out. We could spend the entire session on family, but that's not our assignment. In the 18th verse, wives submit, and that has become a rather politically unacceptable concept. I have had wedding ceremonies where they asked me not to put that in the vows. I don't think I've ever left it out because I think it's a biblical concept, but it's not a culturally comfortable term. But really, it means to willingly subordinate and to be under the obedience. So, ladies, and most of the ladies here are probably married, but if you can't follow the man, don't marry him. because he's not the right man for you. Spiritually or work-related, that might sound harsh, but I tell teenage girls or young ladies, that's part of the package. So don't marry someone that you can't follow, because it's just not what the Bible has asked us to do. It's what the Lord wants. Now, we're not talking about a dictatorship. We're not talking about, I used to say Archie and Edith Bunker, but I've got people here that have never seen Archie and Edith Bunker. So if you've never seen them, ask someone my age or older, and they'll explain Archie and Edith to you. Husband's love. And the word love there is agape. It's not philia. It's not eros. Yes, you should have physical attraction to your wife. But it is the agape love, which means wanting what is best for her. And in Ephesians, Paul says, husband, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Well, how did Christ love the church? He died for it. So, guys, don't marry a lady that you aren't willing to die for them, if that comes to that. Because that's not the kind of love that we're talking here. It's the preference for, the wish well, the regard of welfare. Now, that is agape love. I certainly wouldn't advise someone to marry someone that they don't find attractive. You know, I don't want to stand in front of a couple and go through the ceremony and they look at each other and they go, yuck. That's just not a good start, okay? But it's much more than that, isn't it? It's so much more than that. Wilford Landis, and many of you remember Wilford. I remember I was a teenage person, and he was teaching young people on marriage. And it's always stuck with me. He said, he was talking to the guys, marry a lady that you enjoy visiting with, because during the years you'll spend more time visiting with them than you will in bed. And that always stuck with me. It doesn't mean the other isn't important, but I think he had a very, very wise admonition for us there. Notice that throughout this, we're going to see that phrase, in the Lord. Wives, submit to your own husbands as is fitting, in the Lord. Love your wives as Christ loved the church. This is going to be an ongoing, reoccurrent theme as we go through it. And I think I have a slide that pulls three or four of those together. In verse 20, children, obey your parents in all things, for this is the well-pleasing unto the Lord. Here we're doing it again because of the Lord. And the Greek word for children there is technon, and it is a child, and it carries the idea while under the parents' roof. Now, I believe that we should all honor our parents, irregardless of our age. But the obedience factor, I think, is rather tied to while they're under our dominion. Most of you are old enough, and I am, that we've gone from being in our parents' home to leaving our parents' home, and now some of us have buried our parents. You always honor them. You always honor them, but there is this transition that goes on. You know, when you start out, the parent's up here and the child's down here, so the child is almost totally dependent on the parent. Then you go through a stage of life where you kind of treat each other as peers. And then, if your parents live long enough, the child is up here and the parent's down there, and the parent becomes dependent upon the child, depending upon their physical and mental condition. And I think it was, maybe it was Shakespeare. I'm not an expert on Shakespeare, but in one of his plays, he talks about how we are children twice and parents once. And if you live long enough, you become the child again, you know. Irma Bombeck, I didn't bring the writing with it, but she had a wonderful little writing. She was a very funny lady, but when she got serious, I found her to be very, somewhat insightful. And she talked about how when she had her little children in the car seat beside her, and she had to stop, she'd throw out her hand so they wouldn't hit the windshield, and she'd comb their hair, and she'd tuck them in. And then the whole premise was, when her mother got old and they were driving, she had to put on the brakes and she put her hand out to keep her mother from hitting the windshield. She would comb her mother's hair and then eventually had to tuck her mother in at night. Just a total role reversal. That's part of honoring our parents. And it just sometimes come. I was with an older couple today, and one of their children was bathing and shaving them. And that's just part of it. Well, But here we're talking about obeying the parents in all things, because that's the way the Lord wants to have it set up. And that's what good parents want to do. And most of us were blessed to have good parents. Now, since they're not up here, I'll make this comment. Some of these little ones, they didn't have good parents. They're getting them now, but they didn't have them. So we need to be awful thankful to our parents if we had good parents. And I think most of you probably fall into that category. And if you didn't, just make extra sure you are a good parent. Does anybody have any comment or question you would like to ask, particularly on verses 18, 19, or 20, on the marriage and in the family? I'll be happy to consider it. We've talked about the family on numerous occasions. It's one of my great frustrations, to be quite honest with you. Nora Lee, right there. Just a minute. We want to hear you.
I would say to have a good communication, to try to understand one another and their needs.
Between the husband and wife?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think we could say even between the parent and the child. That is also quite important also, yeah. And children come to parents for different things. Our boys would go to Donna if they just wanted to talk. Now, if they needed something solved, they'd tend to come to me because they knew I'd go into problem-solving mode. Forget this talking. Let's solve the problem. And I'm being a little facetious when I say that, but Donna would always be much more of a listener. But that's all part of the communication. Absolutely. Very good. Anybody else? Lowell.
You mentioned submit. Well, it's when it was fitting. I'm not using exact words you used. You want to comment on sometimes you should submit, and you should submit to if you're a wife?
Okay, yeah, there are times when a wife should not submit. And obviously the classic and most important one is if the husband is asking the wife to do something that's contrary to what the Lord wants them to do. And that would be true of the children too, to some extent. Now maybe not when they're 4 or 5, but we always obey God rather than man, which makes the selection process in marriage so important. We don't have a selection process with parents. I mean, you got whatever parents you got, and you didn't get to pick them. They got to pick whether they had you, but they didn't necessarily pick what kind of person you would be. So that would be an obvious one too. But having said that, even if a woman is married to a man who is not a Christian, Peter says you win him over by your example. That's in 1 Peter chapter 3. So unless it directly contradicts the Lord's command, I don't know, and maybe somebody does know, I don't know when I would recommend not allowing the husband to take the lead. But if he won't let you go to church or whatever, you may have to take a God before husband approach. But I hope that doesn't happen. But I know it does. I know that it does. Anybody want to follow up on Lowell's question or ask another question? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to comment that God knew what he was doing when he created the family unit, because they work so well together. If they're both doing the things that God asked them to do, it's just a perfect union.
Yeah. And I guess I kind of assume that this goes without saying. God did not make man the head of the family because men are smarter. Some men are smarter, but some women are smarter. He set it up that way. I don't know exactly why he set it up that way. But sometimes a lady will find herself married to a husband that doesn't want to lead. My advice to them is make them. Make them by not doing it yourself, if at all possible. Now sometimes it's almost impossible, because there are some dullards out there. But again, I'm back to the selection process. But let's be honest, I think I have a good marriage. But it wasn't because I was smart. I think it's a little bit the grace of God. Now, maybe it's a little bit what we made of it and what you made of it, but what 20, 21, 22-year-olds got it all figured out? Well, I didn't. But I probably had an idea of what I wanted just by being around Christian couples. So maybe I osmotically had a better feel for it than I realized I had a feel for it. But I look back when I first got married, and I'm just amazed at how ignorant I was about life. But Ryan will give us wisdom.
Far from that. I just want to make the comment that I think if a man really, truly does love his wife, he will always, for the most part, take her input in the decisions that
Absolutely.
Are faced with the family.
Absolutely. That's part of not only loving our mates, it's a part of respecting them, because they do have tremendous inputs. My wife has saved me many times from foolishness.
Well, and nowadays, you know, most women are wanting to be empowered and be equal, or, you know, whatever. And it's hard, as being a Christian family, for people from the outside to see that as not being suppressive to the woman, and it's not. It's the way God intended it.
Absolutely. One of the big mistakes that our culture is making is people want equality, and they confuse equality with identicalness. The Bible clearly teaches that men and women are equal. I mean, there's neither male nor female. That's what that means. Men and women are totally equal. That does not mean they are identical. And what we have in our society is a feminist sometimes. In order to be equal, you have to do the exactly same thing the men do. Well, God made us different. And it's just as honorable to raise the children as it is to provide for them financially. And I'm not saying you can't work outside of the home, but I'm saying mothers do things that fathers don't do very well, and fathers do things that mothers don't do as well. And we're still equal, but we don't have to have identical roles in order to be equal, spiritually and emotionally and in the family. And that's one of the big mistakes. I don't hear it as much anymore, but sometimes I would hear young girls say, I want to be like a man, and I would say to them, aim higher than that. I mean, come on. You can do better than that. And that was a little tongue-in-cheek, but it's the men don't have it all figured out. But I could never be the mother that my wife has been. She could not be the father I have been. That's just the way God made us. So it's not a matter of unequalness. It's a matter of strengths and weaknesses that we all have. That we all have. Anybody else want to comment on this before I move on? Okay, well, feel free to. I'm going to move on just a little bit. Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. And I listed here in this very short, like six verses, how many times? Verse 18, fitting in the Lord, fearing the Lord, verse 22, unto the Lord, verse 23, serving the Lord, verse 24. All of this is focused on Christ being in our lives and serving Him. That's why we do it. That's why we need to be good husbands. That's why we need to be good wives. That's why we need to be good parents. Why we need to be good children. Because it's unto the Lord. And it shows those who are outside of the church how a family can function. And that's a wonderful example to show them. And we'll talk a little bit about unbelievers when we get to chapter 4. Verse 21 is very similar to what we see in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged. I put the Greek word that's found in Ephesians 6, 4 there, and they are two different Greek words. Here it is erethizo, which means to stimulate, especially to anger. Fathers, don't try to stimulate your children to anger. In Ephesians 6, 4, it carries the idea of enraging them to disappointment. Now, our children are going to get upset with us. And I think probably if they never get upset with us, maybe our discipline has eluded us. But having said that, that is not the purpose. That is not the purpose. And you have probably seen, as I have, fathers who maybe were intentionally trying to do a good job in terms of discipline, doing it in such a way that the love didn't come with the discipline, and they lost their children, both maybe in the family and in the church. I know of one particular family that I know the father loved his children dearly, but his harshness and his embarrassing them in front of other people, well, he just drove the kids away from church. and it drove the kids away from him. And it was really sad. It was really sad. So we need to learn how to do it in love. And I didn't always do it right, and you probably didn't either. But it is the ideal, and it's what we want to do. The idea of bringing them up in the nurture and admonition, you get this a little bit more in Ephesians, has to do with raise them so that they will be acquainted with the Lord. I think that's an excellent way to say it. We have to raise our children so that they are acquainted with the Lord, so that when they leave us, whether it's college, whether it's the military, whether it's to go get a job in an apartment, the Lord is part of what they take with them. We can't make them, but we want to make sure we have introduced them thoroughly to the Lord. And most of our kids can respond, but they don't all respond. But we need to be very diligent about that. I'm often asked, what makes one congregation grow and another one not? Well, I don't have all of those answers, but I will tell you, high on that list is congregations that keep their young people grow, and congregations that don't keep their young people don't grow. Now, there may be exceptions to that, but there aren't very many in my experience. So we need to nurture them. And that means nurturing children that aren't yours. There are people in our congregation that were paramount in raising our two sons in ways I couldn't, because I could tell them the same thing they told them, but coming from someone other than Dad, it meant more. That's just a fact. So they're looking at us. The only thing I don't like about VBS is all these little eyes are looking at us, at me, and maybe starting to want to be like me, and that scares the bejiggers out of me, because I know me, and they ought to look at you, not me. But they're sponges. They are absolute sponges, so we need to do the best we can. He then goes into, this is the bring them up, raise them so they'll be acquainted with the Lord. He then gets into the servant slave, or the master slave, we might call it the employer, employee type of thing. But he says, don't do it just as eye service. And Thayer defines that as service that's performed only under the master's eye. This would be the employer who works real hard when the foreman or boss is watching and then sleeps when he's not. Obviously that's not a very good example for anybody. I think part of letting our light shine is to give an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, because it's rare. It is very rare. And if you're still in the workplace or have recently been in the workplace, you know exactly what I'm talking about. There's a minimalistic aspect to work many times, or how can I get out of it rather than how can I enter into it with gusto. And I think the current generation is not doing as good a job with that as maybe past generations have done. But that's just my thought on that. Verse 23, whatever you do, do it heartily, as unto the Lord and not unto men. I found it interesting that the word do and do it were two different words. They carry a similar thought, but the first one has to do to make or to do. The second one gets into more of commitment with passion. So whatever activity you choose to engage in, do it with passion and heartily, as unto the Lord and not unto men. When you go to work or when whatever we do, somebody gives you a paycheck. I understand that. But we're working as unto the Lord. We're not. He's the reason we're doing it. Because we need to do it to provide for our families, and we need to do it to honor Him. Yes, somebody signs our paycheck, but a Christian goes about his job much differently than a non-Christian does. Knowing that from the Lord you will receive a reward of inheritance, for you serve the Lord Christ. Only a son can be an heir, and we are sons. That's what Paul tells us in Galatians chapter 4, verse 7. Therefore, you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then you are an heir. And that's why the Lord is our Father. That's why He uses the term adoption. It's why He calls us His children. Yes, we are slaves. Paul uses that phrase frequently. But we are really His the Lord's, and that's why we do it. I think that's, well, one more. But he who does wrong will be repaid for what he has done. And I put Galatians 6:7 there. Don't be deceived. God's not mocked. He sees everything we do, and nobody gets away with anything when it comes to God. He knows exactly what we do. Does anybody have a comment on chapter 3 before I pull a few things out of chapter 4 as we begin to wind down here a little bit? Okay, with your permission, I want to look at chapter 4 for just a minute. And there's lots of things that are in chapter 4, but chapter 3 was just so full that I wanted to take a little bit more than one night on it. In chapter 4, the beginning verses are about being persistent in our prayer life, being prayerful with watching, with thanksgiving in verse 2, and with opportunities to spread the word. Now, I didn't spend quite as much time on this and the ability to speak as I might have, because we had 3 lessons Sunday on prayer. But I want to emphasize something that I said Sunday in these first few verses of Colossians 4 and in the latter verses of Ephesians 6. Paul wrote both of these letters while he was in prison. Never once does he ask them to pray that he get out of prison. He doesn't pray, give me better food because I'm in prison. He doesn't pray, give me a warmer blanket. Both times, Ephesians chapter 6 and here in Colossians chapter 4, he prays that I may spread the word of God. And I just find that to be mind-boggling. I don't think it would have been wrong if he had prayed for something for himself, but both times he defers asking really anything for himself and focuses on, let me spread the word. Let me spread the word. Praying always, verse 3, praying also for us that God would open to us a door of utterance to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I am also in prison. That's his prayer. I'm in prison. I'm not asking you to get me out. I'm not asking you to make my circumstances better. Give me the courage to speak the gospel to people when I'm in these particular situations. Paul said in Philippians, I have learned in whatsoever state I am in, therewith to be content. That tells me a lot. He says, I have to learn how to be content, because contentedness is not a natural thing for Paul, and it's not a natural thing for you or I. But he had learned to do it. And he was reaching people here in prison that he might not have ever reached in any other way. I don't know all of how that played out, but I am just so impressed by his selflessness in his prayer. Not that it would have been wrong, but it just seems to be so selfless and so focused on sharing. Because whether Paul had an extra blanket or better food, he thought that's really insignificant compared to maybe saving a soul. Well, when we put that to our application, there's a lot of lesson there for us that we sometimes miss out. You mean they want me to pick them up for church every Sunday? That'll be really kind of put me out. Well, it might. And I'm just using that as an example. I think Paul would have gone and picked them up if he had the means to do it. Okay. That was a bit of a soapbox, but... Well, before I move on to verses 5 and 6, does anybody have a comment on that aspect of prayer here in the first few verses? I know I spent quite a bit of time on it Sunday, so I don't know that I expect you to. I just give you an opportunity to. Lynette?
Sometimes I think we pray for, seem to be looking for something big to do, and often it's the very little things that make the most impact.
That's true. Yeah, big things happen because of a lot of little things. Yeah, that's true. Every one of us can do these things, or some things. You know, whenever someone tells me I really don't have anything to offer the Lord, I remind him that a donkey carried him into Jerusalem. And if God can find use for a donkey, surely there's something I can do. And I'm not calling us donkeys, but I'm just saying God can use anybody and anything. So let's don't cop out on that. Okay, verses 5 and 6, I mentioned those last night that I wanted to spend a little bit of time on them because they are so important to us. This concept of a winsome walk and winning those who are not believers. Let me read verse 5 and 6. Walk in wisdom toward those who are without. Walk wisely into toward those who don't know the Lord yet. Redeeming the time, and the phrase redeeming the time here and in Ephesians means use every opportunity you get. That's what redeeming the time. It's not really about time management, although that could be part of it. This, what he's literally saying in verse 5 is, walk wisely to those who don't know the Lord, taking advantage of every opportunity you get. Let your speech, verse 6, be always with grace. Speak gracefully to them, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer every man. I think those two verses really give us a huge roadmap on how to deal with people that don't know the Lord. We all know people, neighbors, workers, family members that don't know the Lord. And we say, well, I would just love to win them over. Well, ultimately, it's their choice. I understand that. But here I think we've got a wonderful, wonderful roadmap that Paul is giving them as to how to walk wisely. Implied here is you've got to be with some unbelievers if you're going to have any effect on them. You know, we can get very myopic and isolated in our existence. And we don't want to go out and be tempted to do wrong, but you've got to have some contact with people that don't know the Lord if you're going to win someone to the Lord that doesn't know the Lord. And the using of our time wisely. The Contemporary English translation, which isn't the best translation, but I did like this verse, that it reads, when you are with unbelievers, make good use of your time. When you're with unbelievers, make good use of your time. You know, beauty attracts. We're attracted to pretty people. We're attracted to pretty paintings. We're attracted to pretty sunsets. And I believe people are attracted to spiritually beautiful people. And that's one of the things that Paul is admonishing them to do here in these particular activities. In Colossians 4, in these first few verses, Paul, he starts with a prayer saying, Lord, open the door. Open the door for me to spread the gospel. In verse 4, he says, give me a clear word that I may make it manifest as I ought to speak. Give me a clear way to say it. Let me say it right. And then there's the idea of speaking and walking gracefully. Not combatively, but gracefully. And all of that seems to be Paul's approach. I don't think Paul badgered people when he was in prison to accept the Lord, but I suspect he also had quite a bit of success because of the way that he did it. It's the idea of being willing and being prepared. So one man wrote, and I just jotted this down, what if we treated our Bibles like we do our cell phones? And he wrote, what if we carried our Bible everywhere we go like we do our cell phone? What if we flipped through it several times a day? What if we constantly checked it? What if we turned back if we forgot to take it with us? What if we used it to receive messages rather than text? What if we gave it to our friends as gifts? What if we used it when we were traveling? What if we used it when an emergency arose? His point was, we are so attached to our cell phones, present company included, maybe that would be a good way for us to think about our Bibles as we go through this. Just an interesting couple of verses there that would make a wonderful talk for some of you guys to maybe develop and use in one of your assignments. But walk wisely with those who are without. Take advantage of every opportunity you have. But have your speech be gracious. Not obtuse, but gracious. So you know the right thing to say. Okay. As I move down through verse 6, it's kind of what we commonly call his closing. But it's interesting in these verses 7 through 14, we've got seven men mentioned. Tychicus, Onesimus, Archicus, Mark, Justus, Epaphras, Luke, and Demas. These apparently were some of the traveling companions that Paul had, and I think we're familiar with him ending his epistles in that way. I just have a few comments to make on a few of these men that might be of interest to you or of benefit to us. Tychicus, he says in verse 7, was his beloved brother, faithful minister, fellow servant. He was an Asiatic Christian. He was a native, we're told elsewhere, of Asia Minor. And he was obviously a member of Paul's ministry team. He says, I am sending him to you for the purpose that he may know your circumstances and comfort your hearts. Paul was sending him for two reasons, so that Paul could learn about how they were doing, but he was also sending him to the Colossians so that they could comfort their hearts. And the comfort there comes from Paracleo, which if you study the Holy Spirit in the Gospel of John, where it's called the Comforter, that's a very similar word there. It's the Paraclete. It means to come along near side, to invite, to strengthen and encourage. One of the ways you comfort people is you spend time with them. You get to know them. You have them in your home. They have you in their home. And that's the way we get to know one another, so that we know when a problem is coming before the problem gets to a boiling point that can't hardly be handled. Hospitality is one of the things that the Lord wants elders to have. Be hospitable. He doesn't tell us how hospitable, but it takes work to be hospitable. It takes work to have people in our homes. It takes work to spend time, even with our brothers and sisters, because you know, we all maybe like to prop our feet up more than we should. And this is the idea of comforting their hearts. Onesimus, I think you're somewhat familiar with him. This is the slave of Philemon. The book of Philemon is about that relationship and Onesimus leaving, coming back. He apparently was with Paul in Rome. And he's called a faithful and beloved brother. And in Philemon chapter 1, beginning with verse 10, Paul calls him my son who I have begotten while in my chains. So he probably was converted in Rome while Paul was in prison. That's the way I would interpret he has been gotten while in my chain. So there's a case of Paul taking advantage of an opportunity. And you know the book of Philemon. Onesimus goes back, it appears. In verse 10, we've got Archippus. I'm just listing some passages in Acts where Archippus is listed. You can look at those as you see fit. Don't know much about Archippus other than that. Mark, we are familiar with Mark. This would be John Mark. I think in the King James it's called Marcus. Here he's called cousin, but it comes from the Greek word anapososis, which means cousin or kin of Barnabas. He may have been a nephew. We can't be absolutely sure. I lean toward he was a nephew of Barnabas based upon some other scriptures. But this was the same Marcus that left. Remember, and Paul and Barnabas had that split, but later Paul said, oh, I'm glad Barnabas didn't give up on him because he's of value to me now. So there's a lesson for us there also. In verse 11, we have Jesus or justice. Jesus kind of being the Hebrew origin word, the other one being the Latin origin. Don't know anything really about him other than what we have here, so I won't say anything other than what we have there. There's an interesting thing that happens here, and I don't know what to make of it, so I'm just going to point it out to you. We've got seven men in the closing. The first four were Jews. The last three are Gentiles. Now, is that just coincidence, or is that Paul making sure that the message he is sending them is Jews and Gentiles alike make up the church? I don't want to put words in Paul's mouth. It just strikes me that the last three, Epaphras, Luke, and Demas, are all Gentiles, whereas the first four were Jewish of origin. Epaphras we saw in chapter 2, and we knew a little bit more about him. He's also called a fellow prisoner of Paul's in Philemon chapter 20, or verse 22, pardon me. He was a native of Colossae, and so Paul was sending Epaphras back to Colossae, maybe to carry the message, and to, because he knew the people at Colossae. One, he was of exceptional service. Paul calls him a bond servant. Just totally committed to Christ. Perfect and complete, still referring to Epaphras, means to be fully developed and mature, not lacking in any part. He wasn't sinless, but he just wasn't lacking. He was one of these guys, apparently, like Timothy, that Paul had a huge amount of confidence in. And it's wonderful to work next to someone you have that much confidence in. Luke, we're probably as familiar with Luke as anybody because he wrote the gospel and he wrote the book of Acts. Interestingly enough, however, this is the only passage in the Bible that tells us that he was a physician. If it wasn't for verse 14, we wouldn't know what Luke's occupation was, and we all, I think, kind of know that he was a physician of whatever that meant at that time. Demas, this is a man that later deserted Paul, according to 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 10. So we have a gracious greeting now in the last part of this. I'll read verse 15 and 16. Salute the brethren which are in Laodicea and Nymphas, and the church was in his house. Nymphas was probably a person, the way this reads. So he's greeting the people in Laodicea and the people who met in this church home of Nymphas, as I read it. It may have been in Laodicea, or it may have been in another accompanying town. But I salute you, I greet you. In verse 16, when this epistle is read among you, cause it to be read also in the church of the Laodiceans, that you likewise may read the epistle from the Laodiceans. Now this is the only time I know of that the epistle to the Laodiceans, pardon me, is mentioned. Some think that that was a book that we have under another name. I tend to think that he probably wrote a letter to the Laodiceans that we don't have. God did not canonize and keep, but it probably contained much of the same material that is in Colossae. I have seen what some people say is the book of Colossae, but I don't know if it's real or not, but it's purported to have been. It's only a little one chapter. If it is the one to them, it's only a little one chapter book that really doesn't have anything in it that's not elsewhere. I tend to doubt that was the book. I think if God wanted to preserve it, obviously he would have. But there is a reference here to it. So that's important for us to acknowledge. And then in verse 17, excellent exhortations. And say to Archippus, take heed to the ministry which thou hast received in the Lord, that thou fulfill it. This was Archippus' task, to do what the Lord had said that he would do. And then he ends with a salutation and a benediction. Just a one concluding slide to kind of go back over the book in summary form. The main theme of the book of Colossians is preeminence of Christ. First chapter is all about the preeminence of Christ. Second chapter has warning about false teachings. Remember we talked about Greek philosophies, Judaism, and asceticism. And then he gets into practical livings in chapter 3. We have that series of put these things on, put these things off. The latter part of chapter 3, relationships in life. He gets into the husband, the wife, the parent, the child, the employer, master, slave. And then in chapter 4, as we've just discussed, some of the duties toward those who are outside. I really think verses 5 and 6 are really clarion verses for me, maybe just because they strike me that way. And then a conclusion of admiration for the help that he had. He was always thankful, not only for the brethren, but for this entourage, if you want to call it that, that helped Paul in the spreading of the gospel. It's an absolutely wonderful book, and of course all the books in the Bible are, we would want to say that of, but it's a very concise book that has a lot of information in it. I know some of you have taught the book of Colossians as well as some of, most of you have studied it, but there's just things we always glean out of it every time we go through it, at least I do, and it's a wonderful opportunity to do that.